having to let go of her, she says. We're both wearing our masks, which serves to intensify our eye contact. I just feel like I know her. She's here for me, and I need that, especially after Andy's visit, which was unsettling, to say the least. All those questions about how Doug's holding up, how our marriage is holding up, but nothing about how I'm holding up. And that mini-me bag, it all felt off. But the woman in front of me right now, the woman who's been coming here every day to support me, she's truly my friend. She doesn't blink, doesn't look away. She's got nothing to hide. There's something I need to tell you, I say. I peer down at Sadie, who has fallen asleep. Slowly and carefully, I transfer her back to the plexiglass cube. She drank my milk this morning. Awesome! It really was. It's like she's becoming herself again. For a while there, she just disappeared. She was just a body. But now it's like her spirit has flown back in, her soul. Not that I'm religious or anything. I get what you mean. I feel like she does. That's the thing. I should be in a great mood. Sadie's getting better. Soon she should be coming home. Only I know, in my heart, that the AV should not be our home. Doug feels differently, and we had an argument behind the curtain, conducted entirely in heated whispers. He told me we shouldn't make any rash decisions, that lots of people would kill to be where we are. I told him that maybe someone tried to, that maybe it's not a coincidence that Sadie got so sick after we've been getting all those notes. That's when he told me I was being crazy. And that's when I told him that he might want to stay there for more than the school system, that maybe he wants to stay for the women. He stormed out. But is it really so crazy? I have someone here who might know. There's something I need to get off my chest, I say. Ever since the block party, I've been getting these notes. What kind of notes? The first one said, that wasn't very neighborly of you. Do you know what they were talking about? I shake my head. They just kept coming. They were more antagonistic and personal and threatening, like someone had a vendetta against me. Doug wants to believe they're harmless, like a prank or something. She's nodding slowly. I can't tell if she's surprised. Do you know anything about the letters? Who might have written them? She shakes her head. Have you heard anything? Anyone who has a problem with me? Another head shake. I saved the notes, I say. I can show you if you want. No, I believe you. I'm just thinking... What are you thinking? I'm just thinking how incredibly awful that must have been for you. You're a new mom, in your new neighborhood, and someone's targeting you. My eyes tear up. She gets it. When my own husband doesn't. It has been awful. And scary. I mean, you don't know what they're capable of. Do you have any reason to think that any of our neighbors are dangerous or violent? No. No reason. But she doesn't sound as sure as I would have hoped. She's taking me seriously, and that's actually even scarier. Sadie's a lot better, I say, looking around, wanting to knock on wood but realizing we're surrounded by metal. But they still don't know what landed her here. By process of elimination, they're assuming it's a virus, but they don't know which one or how she picked it up. The world's a germy place. Sadie had never been sick before. Then we go away for a few nights, and when we come back, bam. What do you think happened? Maybe someone snuck into our house while we were away and did something? Like they contaminated her crib sheet or her changing table, something like that? I pause. I know how it sounds, but it's not just notes. A package went missing, and something got slipped in my drink at girls' night, I'm sure of it. And now this. We're dealing with a psychopath here. The more I say it out loud, the more plausible it seems. Maybe that's in part because of her expression. She's really considering the possibility. And she's a denizen of the AV. She knows those people way better than I do. "What would you do if it were your daughter?" I say. "I don't know." "I can see that you do know." She meets my eyes. "I wouldn't go back to that house." "Because Sadie's life is worth more than a house, right? How can Doug not see that? He must not believe that Sadie's in danger." "What does he know that I don't? Or what do you know that he doesn't?" She gives me a meaningful look about the world we live in. Maybe he's the naive one. Maybe he is. I'm getting an eerie feeling, like she gets me a little too much. "Listen," she says, "you're a mother. If you need to protect your daughter, you'll find a way." "Leave my husband, is that what she's saying? Give up on the only family I've known?" "Can I tell you something, and I think in your heart, you'll know it's true?" I take a deep breath and nod. "There might be another reason Doug doesn't want to move. I think there's something going on between him and Andy."
"What makes you think that?" I ask.
She's echoing my own suspicions from earlier when I saw Andy and had this feeling like something wasn't right. The question I'd been posing for weeks, why is she pursuing me, now has an answer. She was pursuing Doug.
"It started on girls' night out."
"The first one or the second?" But I can answer my own question. "The second, while I was passed out."
"Yes."
"Andy's more his type," I say.
"More his family's type, you mean?"
"Why? What did you see?"
"They were getting on like gangbusters in the waiting room. They practically adopted her."
"He's got all the money. His name's on the deed. He's in control. I'm in debt, and I haven't even returned to work yet. I'm not getting paid while I'm on leave. I'm trapped. But I can't leap to conclusions. Just because Andy came in here and brought me body wash and body lotion that made me smell like her, just because she talked like she knew my husband's emotions better than I did, just because my alarm bells were ringing, telling me that this woman could even be the one writing the notes because she wants me out of the picture and she wants my husband, I can't jump to conclusions. I have to talk to Doug. But he's been avoiding me, like a man with something to hide. I thought I was giving Sadie such a good family, I say. But maybe I never really knew what a family was.
Chapter 28, Ellen. On my drive home, I pass by the park. I've always liked that place, even before it got so ridiculously over-the-top fancy. I liked it when it was just swings, a slide, and a climbing structure on top of concrete, rather than wood chips and mats, back before everyone was so afraid of lawsuits and children's boredom. It makes me remember the early days of motherhood, when it was all promise and expectation. Really, it couldn't have gone better today. Kat seemed to just take my word that Doug was having an affair. She might never come back to that house of hers. Who names their house Crayola, anyway? She'll be better off without that guy. I've done her a favor. But I'm not happy. Not at all. She used the word psychopath, and I can't stop thinking about it. I have crossed lines no normal person would cross, because she crossed all sorts of lines. She caused me so much pain. But what if she's right? And I really am a psychopath. I'm just stressed out, that's all. Operation Cat has taken over my life. Maybe it's that I've been missing so much of my own family. I know I can be a better mother than I've been lately. So consumed by my own history, with the latent hatred of Katrina roaring back to life. Since she moved in, I've been fighting the memories. The nightmares have returned. Then there's the anger I'd tried so hard to extinguish. That's why I know I need to get Kat out of the AV. I need to be the best mother I can. But sometimes I feel like I'm just using Kat as a reason to avoid things at home. That she's a convenient excuse for the mess I've made of my own life. Soon, this will all be over. I'll be free of Katrina, and my past will be back where it belongs. I'm doing this for my family, for their future, as much as my own. The ketamine wasn't my idea or my preference, but it has worked in my favor. It's primed her to believe something as preposterous as someone poisoning her daughter. I don't think she's even suspected that it might be more than one person, that multiple people are trying to drive her out. Kat might not have been with Wyatt under normal circumstances, but it was shockingly easy to get her to compromise herself, given how compromised she was. All we had to do was get her and Wyatt outside and move out of the way. She practically pounced on him. No sex drive, my ass. She just isn't driven toward Doug. And Wyatt showing up that night, already drunk, and he and Yolanda were clearly having words that ended with her yanking her arm away. That was all too easy, too. Everyone knows that when Wyatt gets tired of dealing with Yolanda, he rushes into other women's arms temporarily, even though he's going to get an earful when he gets home. Wyatt seems to have taken the idea that it's better to seek forgiveness than permission to heart. While the ketamine wasn't my idea, the pictures were, and sending them to Yolanda from Kat's phone had, I thought, been a stroke of genius. That way it would look like Kat had opted in the second she had the chance, and that she wanted to rub Yolanda's nose in it. It had been my insurance policy. If the openness didn't freak Kat out enough to make her want to leave, then Yolanda telling everyone what Kat had done and the resulting ostracism would. Kat would watch her shiny new future go up in smoke. Instead, I never heard a peep. Everyone could tell that Yolanda didn't like the new girl anymore, but she wouldn't say why. My suspicion is that she didn't want the humiliation, and that she has something else in mind for those pictures, like keeping Wyatt right where she wants him, doing penance. Maybe it'll even give her the leverage she needs to finally opt out. I'm not the biggest fan of Yolanda, with her myriad insecurities, but I do care about Wyatt, and I'm sorry that he's become collateral damage. Lately, I'm just feeling so alone. When this started, it felt like I had support, but it's been dwindling. It could be an attack of conscience or a loss of faith. All I know is there's been more distance since Sadie got sick. Or he might have problems of his own, but I can't be sure. He doesn't burden me with things like that. I've just got this feeling like things are spiraling, and soon it might be beyond any of our control.
Chapter 29. Kat. I just keep picturing them together, Andy and Doug, thinking how much better she is than me in all ways. I can't compete. It's late at night, and Doug is out in the waiting room. I'm practically delirious from the days of sleep deprivation and the stress and strain of trying to figure out what's really happening in the AV. Who's after me? Who's after him? I still haven't confronted him, though my imagination is running wild. It's like texting is a direct link to my subconscious. Maybe we should opt in, I write. Maybe that would solve all our problems. Then Doug can sow his oats and my family stays intact. She texts back. Are those really all your problems? There's the notes. There's the ketamine. There's the possible poisoning of my child. But if Doug and I were just stronger, if we were back to being ourselves, we could survive anything. We could figure this out together. Maybe leaving Crayola isn't the only way. Together, we could find the culprit and make it all stop. We've always been a team. I can't let the AV tear us apart. That's just what whoever wrote those notes wants. They want me to doubt my husband, my marriage, and my sanity. How do you know that Doug and Andy are together? Who told you?
It's all over the block. Everyone knows. It started the same night you kissed Wyatt.
So that's all over the block too?
Yes.
Does Doug know everything?
I mean, does he know I kissed Wyatt?
That I don't know, but if I had to venture a guess, I'd say yes.
So he cheated the same night. But I was drugged. What's his excuse? Was it revenge? Because Andy told him about Wyatt? Or was that just how he gave himself permission to do what he already wanted?
Who he already wanted?
Kat, are you still up?
Kat, are you okay?
I'm always up. But nothing's okay.
Chapter 30. Ellen. Sadie's in a regular room, and I'm dying to see her. Poor choice of words, perhaps. But I just want to verify with my own eyes that she's on the mend, that no babies have been harmed in the making of this revenge tale. Also, I have to remind Kat of what she has to do to save that precious little girl of hers. Last night, I felt her wavering. She even mentioned opting in. That would be the worst-case scenario for me. Not only does Kat stay in the neighborhood, she invades the spreadsheet. She gets into the AV even deeper. Doug's talking on his cell phone outside the room, and when he sees me approaching, he ends the call and stands directly in my path.
"I want you to leave my family alone," he says.
He's not angry, exactly. More like grave. "I'm Kat's friend."
"I'll bet you are."
It's like he knows that I can't be trusted. Like he's actually looking after his wife for once, the way a husband is supposed to. What did Kat tell him? Or could it have been Andy? It would be so like Katrina to tell him about our conversation and make it sound like I'm at fault, like I'm the bad influence. I know she's capable of lying, no matter who gets hurt. I force myself to stay calm. "I'm Kat's closest friend," I say. "I'm the one who's helped her through all this when you were MIA.
"MIA?"
he scoffs. "I've been here the whole time." "There've been some unexplained absences." He glowers.
"I think you should leave now."
"I want to see Kat and Sadie. I want to make sure they're all right."
"Everyone's doing great. Sadie's going to be discharged tomorrow. The last thing we need is stress."
"I don't stress Kat out. I alleviate her stress."
"Can you say the same?"
I start to walk around him, and he grips my arm.
"Do you want this getting around the neighborhood?" I ask. "That you manhandle women?"
Of course, that does the trick. Gotta protect his image. He lets go and steps to the side.
"I'm sorry," he says.
"All of this does a number on your head."
He sounds sincere, but whatever. Inside the room, Andy is chatting up Scott and Melody while Kat plays with Sadie. I can't believe Kat would allow Doug's presumed mistress entrance into her private life. It's like she's got no self-respect at all. The room has two cribs, one at each end, but Sadie's the only child there, so the family's commandeered the entire space. There's an actual door and a window. Even though it's antiseptically white and the view is of the busy boulevard below, it feels lavish compared to Sadie's previous accommodations. Sadie is responding to Kat with smiles and giggles. When Kat sees me, she looks pleased, and I cast a triumphant look in Doug's direction. He doesn't notice. He's already too engaged in the conversation with Andy and his parents. I can't tell if Kat is isolating herself or being frozen out, but there are two camps, Kat and me versus the rest of them. It's like there's one of those invisible electric fences down the center of the room. It looks to me like Kat's in-laws are embracing the mistress. "So, how are you?" I ask Kat. As in love with Sadie as she looks, she also appears entirely exhausted, on the verge of collapse. They think it must have been a virus, Kat says. They're still not really sure. I just need to focus on the most important thing, which is that everything's under control and she's being discharged tomorrow.
Where are you taking her?
I'm taking her home.
Do I detect a note of defiance? Like Kat's telling me my plan isn't working?
Or maybe she just thinks she has no other choice but to go home, so she might as well act like it's what she would have chosen anyway. I know a little something about denial, or at least my therapist said I do. I'm feeling a little tired, I hear Melody say. She looks lovingly across the room at Sadie, and then she crosses the line. Could I hold her before I go? She asks Kat, with exaggerated deference. Kat nods and gives Sadie up. Then she goes and stands by the window, like she can't bear to look at Sadie in anyone else's arms. Scott and Doug encircle Melody and Sadie, a perfect little family tableau.
We're going to drive home now, Scott announces. I think Melody and I could use a night in our own bed.
Melody is making a great show of her reluctance as she hands Sadie to Doug. Then she gives Kat a pro forma kiss on the cheek while Scott doesn't even bother. They close the door softly on their way out.
Then there were three. Well, four, counting Sadie, but three is so much more Agatha Christie. I loved those books.
Kat and I loved them together. We spent an entire summer in the library, reading through the shelf. Sadie is still in Doug's arms, and now Andy's standing way too close to them, alternately cooing at Sadie and looking up into Doug's face. I don't know if she's trying to put on a show and make Kat feel awful, or she's so into Doug as to be completely oblivious. I've never doubted her love and devotion to Nolan before, but now...
Speak of the devil.
I notice Nolan is standing in the doorway, his hands clenched around Fisher's stroller. I don't know how long he's been watching Andy and Doug, but there's a darkness in his face that I've only seen a few times before.
Then he's saying, "Hello, room for two more?"
in a compensatory, jolly tone. Doug leaps up, replacing Sadie unceremoniously in her crib. She emits a protest cry that he doesn't even dignify. He radiates guilt.
So great to see you, Nolan.
I didn't know you were coming,
Andy tells him. She gives him that same smile she gave me just a moment ago. Either she's not guilty or she's much better at concealing it than Doug is.
I wanted to surprise you.
Still in that same jovial tone, but Nolan's eyes are hard. He rolls Fisher forward.
You've been spending so much time here. I thought you might be missing your son.
Nolan and I trade greetings. Then he bends down to release Fisher from the stroller's bindings and, without another word, thrusts Fisher into her arms. She's clearly startled, but recovers well, smiling and cooing at Fisher. Nolan is watching her and Fisher with that same granite expression. For a second, I think that he could be capable of anything. He's that angry with her. He's not the type to allow himself to be cuckolded, not after all he's overcome in his life. Nolan approaches Kat and pecks her on the cheek.
I'm so glad that Sadie's better, he says.
I realize that he hasn't looked at Doug at all, which seems more intense than if they'd been locked in a stare down. He reaches into the area beneath the stroller seat and brings out a grocery bag.
I brought dinner for everyone. Are you hungry?
I forgot to eat lunch, Kat says, as if she's just become aware of the existence of this thing we call food. We were waiting for them to come and move Sadie, and then we waited some more, and now it's 4:30. So, yes, I'm hungry. Thank you. Doug approaches Nolan and claps him on the shoulder in manly appreciation.
You're awesome. Thanks.
Nolan just starts laying out the food like Doug hasn't even spoken. Taking in Nolan's demeanor, it's clear that he believes something really is going on under his nose. I want Kat to think it's true. I don't want it to actually be true. Nolan loves Andy so much. He'd be destroyed. Doug fixes a plate and then brings it over to Kat in an attempt to prove he's a nice guy. Well, wrong room, buddy. Neither Nolan nor I are buying it. But Andy might be, and she could be his actual target audience. Kat takes the plate without a word. That's a good sign from where I'm sitting. She's picking up on what's going on between Nolan and Andy, too, which validates my story. I had to tell a few lies in the texts about how everyone knows about Kat and Wyatt and about Andy and Doug, but it's for a good cause. Nolan says to Andy gruffly, "Who's eating first?" Then, to no one in particular, "Eating in shifts, you know how it is." "You eat first," Andy says. She's on her feet, dancing with Fisher, moving him toward Sadie's crib. "See? It's Sadie. You know Sadie. She's starting to feel better." Fisher stares down at Sadie, and his fussing ceases. It occurs to me that it's not very wise to bring their baby into a hospital. The place is a giant petri dish. Either Nolan is oblivious to that or too angry with Andy to care. Nolan sits with his plate on his lap, watching Andy and Fisher with little expression. "This is good," I tell him, the mashed potatoes melting away on my tongue, and he registers it with the briefest of smiles. Andy gives him a sudden sharp look, at odds with the sweetly maternal tone she's been using on Fisher.
"Hurry up and eat," she says. "I'm starving."
"Then why didn't you tell me to take Fisher first?"
Nolan stands up and storms over to her. I flinch. I feel like I'm watching the homecoming queen and the captain of the football team devolve into domestic violence. Doug must have the same thought, because he half rises, like he's going to intercede if anything dicey happens. So, chivalry is not dead. It's just displaced, onto the other woman. Nolan maneuvers so that he takes Fisher from her and simultaneously thrusts his plate into her hand.
"Here, eat,"
he commands over Fisher's crying. "Give him back to me," Andy says. "He's calm with me."
"But you're starving, remember?"
Andy glares at him and then takes a seat, rapidly shoveling forkfuls into her mouth. I've never seen anything like this between them. So it must be true. Andy really is sleeping with Doug. I'm angry on Nolan's behalf. There are men who deserve that, but he's not one of them. Nolan is normally a good dad, but right then, he's terrible at soothing Fisher. He's rocking him and patting him on the back, talking in a higher register, repeating a lot of the same things Andy said, but to the opposite effect. He's getting increasingly frustrated, and then it seems like rocking is a little too much like shaking, and I'm afraid, because who doesn't realize that you never shake a baby? Even though I'm definitely on Team Nolan rather than Team Andy, I'm glad when Andy takes Fisher back. I can't take the tension another second. "Let's get out of here," I say to Kat, who's also shoveled in all her food. But Kat looks around, like she shouldn't leave Nolan, Andy, and Doug alone, and then it seems like she gets my meaning. We should absolutely leave them alone. Let Nolan take care of whatever's going on between Andy and Doug. She follows me up the hall. There's an alcove with some seats in it, the walls painted in a woodsy nature scene, bright birds in the boughs. "I can't leave Sadie for long," Kat says. "She needs me." A sudden smile. "She's been drinking my milk like crazy today. I thought for sure all that milk would go to waste. But no. She drank like 8 bottles." "That's great. That's why I've decided that no matter what, I'm preserving her family." She smiles again, like she's happy about this decision. She's not fooling either of us.
"You saw what was happening in that hospital room, right?"
I just need to make sure she hasn't lost her faculties entirely, in the wrong direction. I mean, it's okay if her lunacy causes her to flee the neighborhood, but not if it makes her determined to stay. No matter what. You should never utter that phrase in your life, because you never know what's going to matter.
Doug and I just need to get home and get back to normal.
The way he and Andy were acting?
It's like they're throwing their affair in your face.
They're friends.
But the whole neighborhood could be wrong.
I need to get Doug's side of the story.
You mean you haven't even talked to him yet?
Annoyance crosses her face, as in she's annoyed with me, not Doug. I lean in, infusing what I'm about to say with maximum meaning. I'm your friend, and I'm telling you, you can't let him treat you like this. You can't go back to a house where you're getting threatening letters, where you don't know what's going to happen next. You don't know what someone's willing to do. She looks at me with mistrust, and I realize that I might have made a fatal error. I've pitted myself against her husband, leveraging a friendship that she doesn't remember. She doesn't know who I really am.
I'm in a glass house, she says. And I shouldn't throw stones.
It takes me a few seconds to know that she's alluding to her and Wyatt, to what I helped orchestrate. That's part of how she's going to justify staying with her asshole husband. I can't even speak. This is all blowing up in my face. Every rotten thing I've done has been in vain. No way. I'm going to finish the job, one way or another.
Chapter 31. Cat. Don't come back. This is a friendly warning. The email address is a bunch of numbers at Gmail. Untraceable. To me. But maybe it's time to get the police involved, instead of just taking the word of a neighbor who might have his own secrets to protect. That neighbor was the only man I've kissed other than my husband in the past 8 years, and I can't even remember it. Not sure if that makes it better or worse. Is there any way that warning is really friendly? I glance over at Sadie. She's in her hospital crib instead of that plexiglass cube, and her sleep is that of a normal baby. She's just a few hours from discharge. Whoever wrote this email must know that. No, it certainly isn't friendly. Doug's not here. He said that since Sadie's doing better, he needed to go to work today and start catching up. I still haven't asked him about Andy. It's just not the time or the place. We should be home for that. I'm afraid to be back in the AV. But I spoke to one of the doctors about the potential poisoning, and it was clear from his reaction that that's just impossible. So really, it all comes down to a bunch of notes and this email. It's all the work of a bully, plain and simple. A coward who has never dared show her or his face. Meanwhile, I've been tearing my hair out, which must be the point. That's what the bully wants, right? The vast majority of the AV is filled with good people, and no one is going to run me out of town, especially since I have nowhere to go. Not if I want to save my marriage and my family, and I very much do. The prevailing wisdom is that if you stand up to bullies, they cave. I've never tried that. The person who wrote those notes hasn't heard back from me at all. It's time to issue a threat of my own. They might think they've reduced me to a terrified wreck, but they need to know that I'm more of a cornered animal, a mama bear. I can strike back. I try to respond to the email, but it bounces back, undeliverable. So I log into Good Neighbors and write a friendly warning of my own. It could just be the realization that my daughter is nearly healthy and I get to take her home. It could be post-stress euphoria, but I feel empowered for the first time in I don't know how long. I feel like I'm the mother Sadie needs. Like we've survived the worst, and we're only going to get stronger. They were just some notes and an email. Okay, and some ketamine. But what's any of that compared to Sadie's life, which I will protect with my own? I will fight to the death for that little girl over there. I look at the post with satisfaction, and then I curl up in the recliner, and finally, I sleep. I awake to Dr. Vreeland, the cold fish who I met yesterday and didn't much like, though he did serve his purpose. He let me know that the idea of poisoning is nothing more than paranoia.
"Sorry to wake you,"
he says without a hint of a smile. But there is something odd in his manner, and it takes me a second to place it. It's remorse. He rolls a stool over to sit beside me and lowers his voice.
"I'm also sorry for how I treated you."
I blink at him. Am I dreaming this? A doctor actually apologizing?
"I know I was dismissive of your earlier questions, but I've been thinking more about you and about Sadie and about her unusual presentation. When we spoke, I was in a rush, and I thought you were one of those people who just couldn't take good news at face value. Sadie is on her way to a full recovery. All the usual tests and cultures came back negative. But you were still so bent on figuring out the cause. It even sounded like you thought someone might have tried to harm her."
It crossed my mind, but really, I just don't like unanswered questions.
"And honestly, I don't either. So I gave her case more thought and more analysis. A lot of Sadie's symptoms actually correspond to a very rare bacteria called leptospirosis. But leptospirosis has a lot of symptoms, and like I said, it's rare. So rare that to make an absolute determination, we have to send Sadie's samples to the CDC in Atlanta. What I can say is that, based on her clinical presentation and by using microscopy to identify the spirochetes in her urine, leptospirosis may have been present."
I'm not exactly following him. Does that mean she's not okay? That she's not being discharged?
"No. Her prognosis is very good, fortunately. But leptospirosis is found in the urine of cattle, pigs, horses, wild animals, and rarely in that of dogs. You notice how frequently the word rare is appearing in this conversation."
I nod, feeling like I might be dreaming after all. Nightmaring, actually.
"Humans can become contaminated through contact with the bodily fluids of an infected animal, or with water, soil, or food that's been contaminated by an infected animal. You don't have a dog, correct?"
"No."
"You don't live on a farm?"
"No."
"Nor do your family members in Fort Bragg?"
"No."
"The people at highest risk for this very rare bacterial infection are farmers or those who work in sewers, mines, or slaughterhouses. That's why no one suspected leptospirosis in Sadie's case. That, and the infection mimics many other more common viruses."
"So you're saying that if it was leptospirosis, then Sadie was poisoned?"
"I've sent the sample to the CDC for more conclusive results, and what I'm telling you is preliminary. It wouldn't hold up in a court of law, but if it were my daughter, I'd want to know."
I feel like I might have a panic attack, but Dr. Vreeland seems oblivious. He's still talking.
"I should mention, for the purposes of a timeline of sorts, that the incubation period is typically 7 to 21 days, though it can be as long as 30 days. And it's rarely, there's that word again, fatal, if you get medical attention promptly. But sometimes it can cause permanent damage to the kidneys, lungs, and other major organs. In Sadie's case, we've ruled all that out. But permanent damage was a possibility, is what I'm saying. Sadie is one lucky girl. Luck is a relative term.
Thank you, Dr. Vreeland. He stands up.
The nurse will be in with the paperwork in a few minutes.
Oh, God. When I wrote that post on Good Neighbors, I hadn't known Sadie really was poisoned. I've gone and fired a warning shot at whoever tried to hurt her. With that incubation period, it could be anyone. Practically the whole neighborhood's been through our home. I don't know the method of transmission, but it feels like they all had their opportunities. They created them. I text Doug frantically. I need you. Come to the hospital now. We can't go home. 15 awful minutes pass. This is inexcusable. He knows that I'm alone in the hospital with our sick baby. Yes, she's on the mend, but people can take turns for the worse. He's supposed to be making himself available to me. I didn't tell him that when he left because it seemed too obvious. Where's the nurse? Not that I want her bringing me that paperwork. Then we're supposed to vacate the room, and I don't know where to go. I call Doug's cell. He doesn't answer. I call his work line. No answer. I go to his company website and look up his colleagues. I call every one of their numbers until someone answers, and then I say it's an emergency, that I need Doug to call me immediately.
Doug's not in. He hasn't been in since your daughter got sick. It sounds like maybe you misunderstood.
The woman trails off with obvious sympathy. She thinks what anyone would think in this situation. That he lied to me. That I'm a fool. The neighborhood rumors must be true. He is with Andy. I wanted him to talk to Dr. Vreeland and figure out what questions I'd forgotten to ask. I wanted us to call the police together. Then we could sell the house, and if we lose some money, so be it. It's only money. It's not Sadie's life. But I can't reach him, because he doesn't want to be reached. He wants his privacy. He wants Andy. All those unexplained absences. The fights he picked so he could storm off. He's been having an affair while his baby's life was in danger. This is not the man I thought I knew. This is not a man I can trust. If we'd never moved here, would he have just found a different woman in another neighborhood? Or is it really something about the AV? Has this block destroyed us? Or just exposed us? We're safe here, at the hospital. I don't know how we can be safe at home, but I also don't know where else we can go. To a hotel, maybe? Just the two of us? We'd have to tell Doug where we were, or it might be considered kidnapping. Whatever it takes, I will keep her safe.
Chapter 32. Ellen. I've seen Niels driving down the street really slowly on two separate occasions. Casing the joint. That's what they would say in old movies. It weirded me out, even though I've never been of much interest to him. I'm sure Ilsa doesn't know. They look more like brother and sister than most actual siblings. Both so toe-headed, they're practically albino. Both so tall that they've developed the habit of stooping so they won't intimidate. But that's not why Niels was riding so low in the seat. He seemed, absurdly enough, like he was trying to appear inconspicuous. It might have helped if he wasn't driving a Hummer. It's just one more sign of the apocalypse, the walking dead returning to haunt the living. Here's another sign. I barely sleep anymore. So this morning I saw, and heard, Gina and Oliver fighting in the street at the crack of dawn. I was back before the kids woke up, he was protesting. She grabbed his collar and screamed in his face, that wasn't the rule! I've never seen that side of Gina before. Sure, tightly wound people can spring open, but I never thought Gina would be one of those. And as a couple, Gina and Oliver have always seemed rock solid.
I'd assumed that being asexual had some sort of protective aspect to it, like an amulet that would shield her from jealousy. But maybe Tennyson getting it on with Oliver is just too much for her. I want to go outside and tell Gina it's casual. I mean, she knows this. Everything with Tennyson is casual. She's not much for intimate conversation. It'll be short-lived, too. Tennyson and Vic are the best advertisement for why, and how, openness works. If they're out on the street fighting tomorrow, it really will be Armageddon. Then there's Andy and Nolan. If she's not actually having an affair with Doug, she's doing a pretty good job of faking one. I feel like I should do something, help Nolan somehow. But it's not like he's any good at talking about feelings. He doesn't like to admit he has any. But I know how he reveres Andy, and I always thought she felt the same way. If Doug and Andy are together, it will truly be cataclysmic. Then there's Wyatt, who seems so distraught every time I see him on the street. I know Yolanda is putting him through the ringer. I set him up, with no conscience. I was just so single-mindedly focused on getting rid of Kat that I never thought twice about sending Yolanda that picture from Kat's phone. I didn't care what happened to him. I was that obsessed. I'm afraid this whole neighborhood is falling apart, that it's been some gigantic house of cards, and that Kat and Doug were the wind to blow it all down. Or maybe I'm the one who flicked my finger and set it all in motion. My vendetta against Kat, my need to drive her out, is destroying what I love. All that, and I've failed. She's coming back here anyway. It's the only home she has, and that's the only family she knows, and unless I can get Doug to boot her out, I'm stuck with her as my neighbor. I can't talk to anyone, can't get a fresh perspective. My secrets have segregated me from these women whom I've come to love. But do they really know me? They don't even know I'm from Haines. They have no idea who my father is. Katrina knows me best, if she'd just open her eyes. It's like she's blocked me out, pushed me down into the most subterranean part of her subconscious. I feel like even if she changed every feature in her face, I'd still recognize her. I couldn't help it. We were best friends for 11 years, from ages 6 to 17. Then there was the accusation about my father, and I went to her, crying my eyes out, not knowing that she would turn around and go to the police and claim he'd done it to her, too. There weren't that many victims, and most of them dropped out, until only two remained. One of those was Katrina. She testified against my father, who had treated her like his own daughter for years. She had no dad. She had nothing. And my family took her in. She ate dinner at our house practically every night. All those Saturday night sleepovers, all that compassion we had for her, and she turned around and lied. She destroyed us. That's what it was all about. I had the best of everything, and she had so little. I tried to share with her, but that wasn't enough. She wanted to make sure that I was left with nothing. My father insisted upon his innocence, but the town was happy to bring him low. He told me that Haines was full of envious people, and I could see it in their bloodthirst. They practically came out with pitchforks. The jury was rigged. That was the only way they could have convicted him. Having the last name Layton had always been a badge of honor and a source of pride. I'd been from the best family, and now I was a pariah. People looked at me with pity, or with contempt, or disgust, treating me like I was contaminated. The whispers, the ostracism, the loneliness of trying to defend someone who everyone said was indefensible. But he wasn't. He was my dad. He was a good man. And I couldn't say that out loud anymore. No one wanted to hear it. Katrina had gotten her wish.
she'd turned me into an undesirable, just like she was. I was so angry. All the therapy in the world couldn't stop the anger. Really, the therapy made it worse. Being told I was in denial, having to hear the lies from the newspaper about how he groomed all those kids, and sometimes, I have to admit, she even got me to doubt him. There were times I thought that 8 was a lot of victims, and that they were all telling versions of the same story, and that one of those victims was a girl I had loved. There were times in therapy when I started to wonder if it could have happened, and times since. I know my father. My heart knows him. But I can't see him anymore. He's still in prison. I can't visit because the last time I did, I sat across from him and I would never admit this out loud. I had the feeling that maybe he really was capable of what they'd said. I've gone back over that again and again, and I honestly don't know what changed. It wasn't like he confessed. But after he was out of my sight, I revisited all my childhood memories, the way he was with me and the way he was with Katrina. And I knew the truth again. That Katrina and the others had set him up for their own bizarre reasons. I got so furious. It was like I really could have gone on a murderous rampage. I wanted to track her down and kill her with my bare hands. What stopped me was believing in karma, that she'd get hers, that she'd live a terrible and miserable and lonely life. I told myself that I'd live out that old saying about how the best revenge is living well. I found a husband, and I had my baby, and I was accepted into a community, which felt so good after the ostracism my family suffered. But then Katrina showed up in the AV with this husband everyone liked and the most beautiful baby. All the fury came back. I would do whatever it took to get her out of my neighborhood. An eye for an eye. A family for a family. I don't care what some therapist thought. Katrina is the villain, and that's not a narrative. That's the truth. I log into my email, and there's the usual digest from good neighbors. 12 new messages from my neighbors. I scan, my eyes widening as I read the third post. I got your email, and I've had enough of your notes, and I know you're behind the rest of it, too. You know exactly what I'm talking about. I was afraid, but I'm not anymore. I don't even care who else reads this. I can't worry about what anyone thinks of me. Not now. It's gone too far. I just care that you're reading. You're somewhere on this site, and you're on my block, and I'm going to find you. I'll do whatever it takes to stop you. Anything. So, instead of Kat leaving the AV, she's putting us all on notice. She's so unhinged that she's going vigilante, and she wants us to know it. I can't tell if she's bluffing. What I do know is I never wrote any email, and he wouldn't have either. Which means that either Kat's truly batshit and is conjuring phantom emails, or this has officially gotten out of control.
Chapter 33. Cats. Doug and Sadie are both asleep, and I wish I could join them. But I can't stop thinking about who might be behind the notes, and now the email, who roofied me, who poisoned my child. All that, and I'm still in this house. Because it occurred to me that running might not end it. If someone hates me that much, they could follow me anywhere. So I'll stay. Embedded in this neighborhood, where I can find the clues and the proof. Then they'll pay for what they've done. They'll be locked up like Layton, and I'll be truly free. Sadie and I will be safe. Though if I'm honest with myself, having Layton behind bars hasn't released me from my own prison of shame. Dr. Morrison talked about how brave it was of me to testify against Layton, how I protected all the other little girls he might have gone on to victimize. But when I testified, I was only 17, and I wasn't thinking of the little girls in the future. I was thinking of the little girls in Layton's past. Learning that I wasn't actually special, that there had been others, devastated me. Ellen came to my house to tell me that her father had been falsely accused, and my first thought was, "It's all true." And I wasn't the only one. I was such a fool. Layton and I had been together from when I was 10 until I was 13. Until I started to look more like a woman and less like a girl. But what he told me at the time was that he needed to end our relationship because it was wrong. As much as he loved me, I was his daughter's best friend, and even though his marriage was nothing but an empty facade, he needed to rededicate himself to it for his children. He made it sound like a terrible sacrifice, like losing me was practically killing him. But it was bullshit. He was moving on to other prepubescents. He'd lied to me. I'd been so hurt and so angry, and I didn't know what to do about it. I thought that Ellen deserved to know who her father really was, and before I went to the district attorney, I told her. She didn't believe me, but I was sure she'd come around. Then there were all these other victims coming forward, and I found out just how not special I was. We were all just so horribly similar, all duped in the same exact ways. One by one, they dropped out. Their parents changed their minds or they had emotional breakdowns, until it was just the original accuser and me. Ellen stood by her father. She even manipulated for him, begging me not to testify. She didn't stop me, but she made me feel guilty. It was terrible. Being on the stand, having to look at Layton, the only man I'd ever loved, I didn't have a father after all, and looking out at Layton's wife, who'd treated me so kindly and who resembled Ellen, I was tearing apart their family, and for what? For vengeance. I was punishing him for the fact that I wasn't special at all. I was just stupid. But I'd loved him. I didn't love all the sexual things, not on their own, but I loved making him happy. He tried to end our relationship a bunch of times, and I seduced him back. I was 10 and 11 and 12 and 13, feeling powerful, feeling irresistible. Then I hit puberty, and he could resist me all right. Intellectually, I know that makes him a pedophile. But sometimes I still don't know what it makes me. Here I am, with a husband who's supposed to love me, who's supposed to have chosen me above all others, forsaken all others, and I'm still so stupid. I don't know where he was when he was supposed to be at work, not for sure, but I have a pretty good idea. What I do know is that I was terrified when I brought Sadie home by myself. Letting myself back into Crayola, i.e. the scene of the crime. I know that I disinfected every surface twice over. I know that I was afraid to put Sadie down anywhere, that I just kept her clutched to me. I know that this is not what home should feel like. I know that Doug continued to ignore me for hours, until he walked inside at 6 p.m., pretending it had been a long day at the office. He was obviously genuinely thrilled that Sadie was back with us, and he asked questions about how she was. As an afterthought, he asked about me. What I didn't tell him was that I'd called the police. That two officers came out and took my statement. They also took all the cardboard notes, except for, "Does your husband know?" I hid that one. Wanting to retain some evidence of my own and not wanting them to wonder what it was that my husband doesn't know. I can't afford to lose any credibility with such an incredible story. I've already forgotten the officers' names, though I wrote them down. I thought of them as Big and Little, for obvious reasons. They seemed sympathetic about Sadie's recent hospitalization, but Big raised an eyebrow about Dr. Vreeland's intimation of poisoning, like he thought maybe the doctor was some kind of quack. "Do you know Dr. Vreeland?" I asked, and they shook their heads. "He's very professional," I told them. "He has no reason to make anything up."